The moment Lord Adrian Blackwell opened his mouth at his own engagement banquet and said those four words, "She is too plain," every fork in that chandelier-lit dining hall stopped moving. And not slowly. They stopped the way a heart stops when it gets news it didn't prepare for. Sudden. Final. Like the whole universe just forgot how gravity worked for 2 full seconds. He didn't whisper it. He didn't mutter it into a napkin or let it slip under his breath to a trusted friend. No. Adrian Blackwell, Duke of Renmer, said it loud enough for the string quartet to catch it between notes, loud enough for his mother to turn the precise shade of white that only mothers of terrible men can achieve, and loud enough for the woman sitting 3 seats to his left, his betrothed, Miss Cecilia Voss, to hear every syllable land like a gavel on marble. 300 guests. Crystal glasses still raised in toast. Cecilia's champagne untouched. And the worst part? He was smiling when he said it. Not a cruel smile, which almost would have been better, because cruelty you can name and throw back. This was a bored smile. The smile of a man who had already decided the evening's outcome and was simply narrating it for the audience's benefit, like a naturalist describing an unremarkable species of moth. Plain. Common. Forgettable. Now before we go any further, I need you to understand something. Because if you walk into this story thinking that what follows is about a woman crushed and rebuilt, you are going to miss the entire point. This is not a story about a woman who was broken and then recovered. This is a story about a woman who was never broken, in a room full of people who thought she was, surrounded by a man who had just made the most expensive mistake of his comfortable life, and didn't know it yet. Here is what you need to understand about Cecilia Voss. She was 26. She had gray eyes the color of winter sea, not the romantic kind of winter sea from paintings, but the actual winter sea, deep, cold, and full of things that would surprise you if you went in without knowing what lived there. Her hair was dark brown, kept simply, without the elaborate architectural towers of curls that other women of her social circle treated as a competitive sport. She was of average height. She dressed well but without spectacle. She did not perform joy for rooms full of people. She did not laugh at jokes that weren't funny just because the man making them had a title. She read 3 newspapers a day, spoke 4 languages, managed her late father's entire estate at the age of 22 after the solicitors all told her it was too complex for a woman, every single one of them, in sequence, with their practiced expressions of concern, and then proceeded to triple its value in 4 years while those same solicitors quietly updated their assumptions about women and never once acknowledged they had done so. She was not flashy. She was not decorative. She was the kind of woman that foolish men consistently underestimated and consequently lost to. And Adrian Blackwell, Duke of Renmer, was about to discover which category of man he belonged to. Spoiler alert, not the smart one. Let us, for the sake of completeness and because it is genuinely instructive, establish who Adrian Blackwell was before we watch him unravel. He was 30 years old. He was tall, which he treated as an achievement. He was handsome in the way that men who know they are handsome tend to be, polished, certain, slightly too aware of their own angles in the mirror. He had inherited his title at 22 when his father died in a manner that was perfectly respectable and left behind an estate that was, upon closer inspection, considerably less so. He had a good education from the right schools, the kind that teaches you to speak well and think in straight lines and never seriously question whether the lines are pointing anywhere useful. He had opinions about horses, about wine, about other men's financial decisions, and about women. Especially about women. He had the specific and entirely unearned confidence of a man who has been told all his life that his opinions mattered and has never had sufficient evidence to revise this belief. His friend, Viscount Harley, was the worse version of him, which is saying something, because the better version was already not setting any records for excellence. Harley had no fortune, limited distinction, and considerable loyalty to anyone who would laugh at his jokes, which Adrian reliably did, which cemented their friendship on a foundation that was essentially two men agreeing to find each other impressive for the next 30 years. This is more common than it should be. The engagement had been arranged, as these things so often were in their circle, through a series of carefully orchestrated coincidences that were neither coincidences nor careful. Adrian needed money. Not desperately, not yet, but the Blackwell estate had been bleeding quietly for 3 years, the result of his father's catastrophic investment in a shipping venture that had sunk, both literally and financially, off the coast of Portugal. A ship full of goods, a storm of considerable ambition, and a captain who had been optimistic about the weather in the way that only truly foolish people are optimistic about the weather, by ignoring the forecast entirely and describing the clouds as character. The investment was gone. A portion of the estate income was leveraged against loans that were now becoming restless. The kind of restless that creditors get when they've been patient long enough and have other people they could be being impatient with instead. The Voss fortune, on the other hand, was the kind of fortune that had opinions about itself. Old money married to new enterprise. Her father, the late Cornelius Voss, had built textile mills across the north of England and then, with a foresight that most men couldn't have located with a map, a guide, and 3 days of uninterrupted thinking, had pivoted those mills to industrial machinery just as the demand for textiles softened and the demand for the machines that made other things exploded. When he died, he left Cecilia not just money but a machine that made money, and she had not merely maintained it, she had made it sing. The match had been proposed by Adrian's mother, the Dowager Duchess Miriam, who had the strategic instincts of a military general and the social grace to disguise them as maternal concern. She was the kind of woman who appeared, in social settings, to be making conversation, while actually conducting surveillance. She had met Cecilia twice, sized her up with the efficiency of a jeweler assessing a stone, and decided the girl would do. Not because she was dazzling, she clearly wasn't, not in the surface way Miriam had trained herself to evaluate, but because she was competent, and the Blackwell estate needed competent far more urgently than it needed dazzling. The Dowager Duchess had been managing that estate's reputation for 8 years against the headwinds of her son's personality, and she was tired. She needed reinforcements. Adrian had agreed. Passively. The way he agreed to most things that didn't involve his own comfort or pleasures. He had looked at Cecilia's portrait, noted that she was not what he would have chosen had choice been entirely his, and then signed the papers with the sort of resigned pragmatism that he believed was the mark of a mature man. It was not. It was the mark of a coward who wanted money without the inconvenience of earning it himself, but that's a distinction he hadn't yet been asked to confront. They had met formally on 4 occasions before the engagement banquet. Each time, Cecilia had been perfectly pleasant, quietly observant, and entirely herself, which, as it turned out, was the thing Adrian found most irritating. Most women in her position would have been performing. Working harder to be interesting, to be impressive, to be wanted. Laughing a little louder. Angling slightly more. Asking questions about him with an enthusiasm slightly larger than genuine curiosity required. Cecilia simply existed in the room as though her presence required no justification, and something about that unnerved him in a way he didn't have the vocabulary to name. So he named it something easier. He called it plainness. He called it dullness. He told Harley, over brandy one Tuesday, that she had all the magnetism of a Wednesday afternoon. Harley laughed. Because Harley always laughed when Adrian said things like this. And Adrian, who needed to be the funniest person in his immediate vicinity at all times because it was the only variety of power he exercised freely, filed it away for future use. He should not have filed it for future use. He should have discarded it immediately and examined the impulse that produced it. But that requires a level of self-awareness that Adrian Blackwell had been inoculated against by 30 years of everyone around him treating his observations as wit. The engagement banquet was held at Renmore House, the Blackwell family estate in Mayfair. It was a spectacular house in the way that monuments to bad spending tend to be spectacular, all gilded ceilings and portraits of ancestors who looked increasingly uncomfortable as you moved backward through the centuries, as though the family itself was aware that it was declining and had decided to process that grief through interior decoration. The ballroom could seat 300. On this particular evening, it seated 300, all of whom had come with some version of the same expectation, a pleasant evening, good food, the formal ceiling of what everyone understood to be a practical and reasonably sensible arrangement. Cecilia arrived in a gown of deep blue silk, not fashionable exactly, but well-made, quiet and precise as everything about her. She had brought her cousin Eleanor as her companion, a woman 2 years her junior who possessed everything that society considered feminine virtue. She laughed easily, blushed prettily, talked about nothing with the fluency of someone who had been carefully trained to do so and had internalized the training so completely that she now did it automatically, like breathing. Eleanor was sweet. Eleanor meant well. Eleanor would, later that evening, cry on Cecilia's behalf in the ladies' withdrawing room, which Cecilia would find both touching and mildly exhausting, because Eleanor cried about things the way other people breathed about things, constantly and without apparent effort. The dining hall was magnificent in the performative way of these affairs. 20 courses down to 7, by the modern fashion. Wine enough that no one would remember the evening exactly, but everyone would remember it generally as having gone well or having gone badly, depending on which side of the blast radius they ended up on. Cecilia was seated to Adrian's left, as was appropriate, which meant she spent the first three courses being talked at rather than talked to, because the gentleman on her right turned out to be Lord Pemberton, an elderly widower who was genuinely, extensively, and somewhat alarmingly knowledgeable about Roman aqueducts. This would prove fortuitous in ways that neither of them anticipated at the time. She and Pemberton fell into conversation about the engineering principles behind ancient hydraulic systems with the unguarded enthusiasm of two people who have unexpectedly discovered that the other person actually knows what they are talking about. Cecilia had read Frontinus. She had read him in the original Latin, with annotations, on a rainy February afternoon when she was 19 and looking for something to do with her mind that was proportionate to its ambitions. Pemberton had visited Rome twice specifically to see the Aqua Claudia. They were, between them, more interested in aqueducts than anyone else in that dining room, and possibly anyone else in Mayfair, and they were both aware that this was somewhat eccentric and both entirely unbothered by this awareness. Adrian, from his seat at the head of the table, watched this exchange. He watched Cecilia's face as she talked, the specificity of her attention, the particular quality of animation that appeared there, entirely without calculation, entirely real, and he found he was irritated by it. She wasn't looking at him. She was ignoring the primary occupation of most women in her position at most events of this kind, which is managing the impression they make on the person they are supposed to impress. She was talking to old Pemberton about aqueducts. He told himself he was bored. He was not bored. He was bothered, and he lacked the self-awareness to distinguish between the two, which is a very common problem in men who have been told their feelings are valid without anyone checking what the feelings are valid about. And then the toast began. Harley went first, because Harley always went first when there was an opportunity to perform in Adrian's direction. Viscount Harley stood, adjusted his jacket with the self-satisfaction of a man about to demonstrate his cleverness, and delivered a toast that was, on the surface, in its literal content, perfectly correct and only between the lines, in the tonal subtext that the socially fluent among the guests would have decoded in real time, revealed itself to be gently, precisely, deliberately mocking. He praised the Duke's practical wisdom in selecting a bride. He celebrated the sensible union of complementary qualities. He described the match as a thoroughly reasonable arrangement. He used the word suitable 3 times in 2 minutes, and in this room, among these people, at this dinner, the word suitable was not a compliment. It was the polite word for good enough, the word you use when you want to imply, but not exceptional, without the social liability of saying it directly. It was the verbal equivalent of calling someone's house convenient when you meant small. Every person in that room with sufficient social fluency understood exactly what was being communicated. And there were at least 250 of them. Cecilia heard it. She took a sip of water, not champagne, water, with the calm deliberateness of someone who is not going to let the evening's proceedings determine whether she enjoys her champagne, and continued to appear entirely unbothered. Which, if Adrian had been paying the right kind of attention, would have told him something important. People who are genuinely shaken by a blow do not look this composed. They either fail to hide the shake or perform composure in a way that shows the seams. Cecilia's composure had no seams. It was structural. Load-bearing all the way down. Then Adrian stood. The room collected itself into the kind of attention that gathers around the person everyone knows is about to speak. The sound of 300 people not moving was its own particular kind of sound. He lifted his glass. He looked around the room with the comfortable authority of a man in his own house, surrounded by people who existed within his gravitational pull. He said a few words about tradition, about family, about the union of great houses, about the privilege of good stock recognizing itself across a dinner table. He was not without charm when he chose to deploy it. That was the thing about men like Adrian that made them so specifically exhausting. They had enough of the right tools that you kept hoping they'd build something decent. And then they didn't. He turned toward Cecilia. Something in his face shifted. Something that was one quarter boredom, one quarter performance, one quarter the particular drunk on being watched feeling that overtakes certain men at certain dinners, and one quarter something darker and pettier that he would never have named if he'd had 1,000 years and a very good therapist. "I'll admit," he said, in a tone that carried with it the ghost of a laugh he hadn't quite committed to, "that when I first saw Miss Voss's portrait, I thought to myself, she is too plain for me. He paused, letting the word sit in the air, letting the silence do its work. But I have since been persuaded that a duke does not require ornament. Another pause. He requires utility. Utility. He used the word utility. For a woman. At their engagement dinner. In front of 300 people. Including her elderly cousin from Dorset who had traveled 4 hours by carriage to be here and was now frozen mid-sip with an expression of pure astonished horror. The silence that followed was not a regular silence. It was the kind of silence that arrives with mass and temperature. It had pressure. It pressed on the eardrums. It was the silence of 300 people simultaneously processing the same information and arriving, within about 2 seconds, at the same conclusion, which was, he did not just say that. He did. Lord Pemberton, on Cecilia's right, slowly, carefully, set down his fork. His expression was that of a man who had survived enough of the world to know that what he had just witnessed was going to have consequences, and who was deciding very quickly how far away from the blast radius he wanted to position himself and whether it was too late to move. Eleanor, across the table, went the color of a peony. And then the color underneath a peony. And then a color that didn't have a name but was somewhere in the general territory of a woman who has just witnessed something so awful that her body has decided to register it physically rather than wait for the mind to catch up. The Dowager Duchess Miriam, at the far end of the table, pressed her lips together into a line so thin and so flat that it was essentially a mathematical concept rather than a feature of a face. Her expression said approximately 12 things simultaneously, none of them good for Adrian, and she said all 12 of them by saying nothing at all. Harley, to his small credit, looked at his plate. And Cecilia? Cecilia turned and looked at Adrian with those Wintersea eyes, and she smiled. Not the smile of a woman swallowing rage. Not the smile of a woman fighting tears, pressing them back with the sheer force of social training. Not the fixed, brittle, terrible smile of someone keeping a performance together that is about to fall apart. The smile of a woman who has just watched her opponent reveal his hand at a card table, and is privately, quietly, completely delighted. She raised her champagne glass, the first time she'd touched it all evening, and she raised it with the easy unhurried grace of someone making a choice, and she said, in a voice that the entire table could hear without her needing to raise it even a fraction. To utility, then. May it serve us both as well as it served the Romans. Lord Pemberton, who had spent 3 courses discussing Roman engineering with this woman and understood the reference instantaneously and completely, made a sound, a short, involuntary bark of genuine appreciation, before collecting himself with the skill of a man who had been attending dinners like this for 50 years. Half a dozen other guests who caught the reference did something similar with their faces. Adrian blinked. He hadn't expected that. He had expected, if he had expected anything, which he probably hadn't, because expecting implies advance consideration of other people's inner lives and this was not a skill he possessed, he had expected tears, or a rigid silence, or a small dignified collapse that he could interpret as confirmation that he was correct and she was indeed simply not up to the standard of someone like him. He did not have a category for this response. He couldn't file it anywhere. So he laughed, slightly, because laughing is what Adrian did when he didn't know what else to do, and he sat down. He should not have sat down thinking it was over. It had barely begun. What happened over the next 3 weeks happened quietly, which is to say, it happened the way the most significant things happen, not with announcements and drama and scenes but with a series of small, deliberate, irrevocable choices made by someone who had already decided on the destination and was simply managing the route with the efficiency of someone who has read the map and doesn't need to consult it again. Cecilia began the process of untangling her affairs from the proposed marriage. She did this the morning after the banquet, which means she woke up, made tea, sat at her desk, and began making notes. Not in anger. In clarity. She had a distinction between these two things that most people spend their whole lives failing to maintain, and she maintained it as naturally as breathing. Her solicitor, a man named Graves, thin, precise, the sort of man who sharpened pencils as a form of stress management and was consequently always surrounded by very sharp pencils, confirmed that the preliminary agreement carried financial penalties for withdrawal but no legal obligation of the marriage itself. The Blackwell estate had been counting on the Voss capital as security against 3 outstanding loans. Without it, they would need to refinance within the year, at considerably less favorable terms, because the kind of lenders who extended favorable terms to estates in distress were not the kind of lenders who waited patiently while you sorted out your love life. She knew this because she had done her research before the engagement was announced. She had done her research before she ever agreed to attend the first formal meeting. Cecilia Voss did not walk into rooms without knowing what the walls were made of. She did not enter arrangements without understanding the structure of the arrangement. She did not, as a general policy, do anything at all without first knowing more about the situation than anyone else in the situation expected her to. She sent Adrian a letter. Short. Precisely courteous. Devastating in the way that genuinely devastating things are devastating, not through volume or drama, but through exactness. Dear Lord Blackwell, I write to inform you that I will not be proceeding with our engagement. I wish you well in finding an arrangement more suited to your requirements. I trust utility will prove sufficient consolation. Yours sincerely, Miss Cecilia Voss. For sentences. The last one with a small knife in it, placed so quietly that he'd only feel it once he stopped moving. She sealed it, addressed it, handed it to her footman, and went back to the estate accounts she'd been reviewing before she was interrupted by the necessity of ending an engagement. Adrian's first reaction, when his valet read him the letter the following morning, at 10 o'clock, while Adrian was still arranged decoratively among his pillows in the way of men who treat their beds as thrones, was to laugh. Actually laugh, with the genuine amusement of someone who is certain they understand the situation better than all available evidence suggests. She's bluffing, he told Harley over breakfast, which arrived 45 minutes later. This is what they do. They perform injury. She'll come around within the week. He sent no reply. He waited. She did not come around. The formal withdrawal of the engagement became social knowledge within 48 hours, which in their world was actually quite slow. The information infrastructure of their circle could typically process a scandal in 24. The story, as it traveled, accumulated details. The specific words Adrian had used at the banquet, the too plain, the utility, traveled with it, because there had been 300 witnesses and not all of them were kindly disposed toward him, and several of them had excellent memories and good diction and found themselves repeating the story with the investment of those who feel they witnessed something historically interesting. Too plain, people murmured in drawing rooms, over tea, in carriages, in the vestibules of clubs. He actually said too plain. And utility. He said utility. The incredulity did not diminish with retelling. If anything it grew. Because the more you repeated it, the less possible it seemed that a man had actually stood up at his engagement dinner and described his betrothed as a useful appliance, and yet here was the evidence of 300 witnesses, and here was the man himself, declining to deny any of it. Adrian's version of events, offered to those who directly asked, with the confidence of someone who genuinely believed he was the injured party in a situation he had created, was that Miss Voss had proven herself temperamentally unsuitable. Sensitive. Given to overreaction. Unable to appreciate the pragmatic honesty that distinguished sensible people from sentimental ones. He deployed the word hysterical twice before enough of his female acquaintances gave him looks of such concentrated cold that he retired it. He tried oversensitive. He tried difficult. He tried not suited to the demands of a household of this standing, which made approximately no sense given that the household of that standing was the one currently drowning in its own debts. None of these framings helped him. They made things worse, consistently, in the way that the attempts of the guilty to establish their innocence tend to make things worse, because every time he explained the situation in a way that cast him favorably, someone who had been at that dinner table corrected the record. The Dowager Duchess Miriam did not speak to her son for 11 days. When she resumed speaking to him, she did so exclusively on the subject of estate finances, in the tone of a woman who has accepted a terrible situation and has decided to get through it with whatever dignity the situation can be made to accommodate. She never once mentioned the engagement, which was in many ways worse than if she had spent those 11 days shouting at him about it. The shouting would have given him something to push back against. The silence, followed by financial discussions delivered in the tone of a general briefing troops before a retreat, gave him nothing but his own reflection, and his own reflection was not being especially kind to him. Now here is where the story tilts on its axis, as all the best stories do. Here is where the thing that was already in motion reveals itself to have been in motion for considerably longer than anyone suspected, including, and this is the really beautiful part, including the person who set it in motion. Because Cecilia Voss had met someone at a charity concert 6 weeks before the engagement banquet. She had not been looking. She was, in fact, actively skeptical of the idea that meaningful things announce themselves with convenient timing and appropriate music. She was at that concert because she supported the children's hospital being funded by the evening's proceeds. She had been on the fundraising committee for 2 years and had personally negotiated the venue discount, and she had a seat in the third row, and the seat next to her had been empty for the first 4 minutes of the Haydn, and then it was occupied by a man who arrived in a state of slightly breathless apology, with his coat still damp from the outside air, because his carriage had been delayed by a horse who had developed, at precisely the wrong moment, strong opinions about a puddle. He slid into the seat with the minimal disturbance of someone practiced at arriving late to things, turned briefly to acknowledge his neighbor in the way that theater etiquette requires, and whispered, with remarkable precision for a man who had literally just come in from the cold, "Are they still on the Haydn, or have they moved to the Beethoven?" Cecilia, without looking away from the orchestra, whispered back, "Still Haydn. You have approximately 6 minutes before you're expected to appear to have always been here." He turned and looked at her with an expression of equal parts startled and delighted, the particular expression of someone who has said something minor and received something interesting in return and is now recalibrating. For reasons she didn't fully examine at the time, she felt something shift, a barely perceptible structural adjustment, like a building settling, or like something that had been slightly misaligned for a long time very quietly correcting itself. His name was Sebastian Montague, Marquess of Ashford. 32 years old. Owner of the largest private bank in England, 3 manufacturing interests, a shipping company that was emphatically and conspicuously not sinking off the coast of Portugal, and several thousand acres of estate in Surrey that he managed with the practical diligence of someone who understood that land was not an inheritance but a responsibility. He was, in the vocabulary of their world, enormously wealthy, the kind of wealthy that didn't need to perform itself, that wore coats that were excellent quality but not obviously so, that drove sensible carriages, and that still made every banker in London straighten involuntarily when he walked into a room, the way you straighten when you feel a change in atmospheric pressure. He was also, and this was what mattered to Cecilia more than the balance sheet, which mattered to her but was not the primary metric, genuinely, demonstrably interesting. He had opinions that he had formed himself through the inconvenient process of thinking and observing and occasionally being wrong and updating. He argued when he disagreed, without aggression and without the performance of reluctance. He listened when he was wrong, which is rarer among men of his standing than the social contract requires us to pretend. He had a sense of humor that came from actually looking at the world rather than from wanting people to look at him. They had talked through the intermission. Because that is what people do at concerts. When the music has made them briefly more human, they turn to the person nearest them and try to sustain the feeling through conversation. She had expected, because she was experienced in certain particular disappointments, that the conversation would thin out once it moved away from the immediate excuse of music. It didn't thin. It broadened. It moved from music to engineering to the concert hall's acoustics to the architecture of the building to the question of whether beautiful buildings make people behave better in them, which was a real debate with real evidence on both sides, and they were both on different sides, and neither of them were prepared to concede, and by the time the bell rang for the second half they were in the middle of something neither of them wanted to stop. He called on her, formally and correctly, the following week, and the week after, during the period of her engagement to Adrian, which was, in total, not very long. He maintained a respectful distance, because he was a man who understood the difference between pursuing someone and respecting the situation they were in, and he possessed the patience to act accordingly. They were friendly acquaintances. They attended some of the same events. He was always pleased to see her, in the observable, unperformed way of someone who is actually pleased to see someone rather than someone signaling that they are pleased to see someone. Cecilia was aware of him, with the peripheral awareness she maintained about everything that mattered, with the steady background consciousness of something she had noted and had not yet decided what to do with. When the engagement dissolved, he sent a note. Not flowers, which would have been premature and possibly misread. Not a visit, which would have been presumptuous and in poor taste. A note, in handwriting that was legible and direct, with the enclosed article on Roman aqueducts from last month's engineering journal, because he had remembered their conversation about Frontinus at a mutual friend's dinner 3 weeks prior, and had thought she might find it interesting, and had been correct. She read the article in one sitting. She wrote back 4 pages, because if you were going to discuss Roman aqueducts with someone who had also read Frontinus, you might as well do it properly. She covered the article, added two sources she thought he'd missed, and then accidentally continued into a broader argument about the relationship between infrastructure and civic identity that she hadn't intended to make but which emerged naturally and which she felt, upon reading it back, was actually quite good. He responded in 2 days, faster than the Post usually managed, which suggested a certain level of attention to the arrival of correspondence, and his response was 8 pages, which was longer than the letter that prompted it, and which disagreed with her on 2 specific points so precisely and so well that she found herself genuinely pleased rather than defensive. Because there is a particular pleasure in being argued with by someone who has read what you said carefully enough to argue with it accurately. They were seen together at an exhibition at the Royal Academy 3 weeks after the engagement ended. Then at Lord Pemberton's dinner, Pemberton, who had witnessed the original event and was himself a great fan of outcomes that had the structural satisfaction of good stories, had arranged the invitation with the satisfaction of a man placing the final piece of a puzzle he'd been quietly working on for some time and had not told anyone about. They were seen riding in the park, in the early morning when serious riders go, which is a different activity from the social promenade and involves actually going somewhere rather than being seen going somewhere. They were seen at the opera, second box on the left, Cecilia in deep green that should not have worked and did, Sebastian leaning toward her with the focused attention of a man who is not pretending to listen but actually listening, which is in this context quite a different thing. Cecilia arrived with Eleanor, who was on this occasion serving simultaneously as companion, witness, and barely contained enthusiasm. Eleanor had opinions about what was happening and was exercising considerable restraint in not sharing all of them simultaneously. Sebastian met them in the entrance hall. He greeted Eleanor with the genuine courtesy of someone who understood that the people important to people he cared about deserved to be treated accordingly. Then he looked at Cecilia in the way that certain people look at certain other people, the way that requires no translation and no explanation, and that Cecilia, who had extensive experience in identifying the performed versions of most things, recognized immediately as the unperformed version. He said, quietly enough that only she could hear it, "I've been thinking about your argument on page 4 since Tuesday. You're right and I find it extremely inconvenient." She laughed. The real laugh, the one that starts in the chest and doesn't ask permission from the room first. And the people nearby who registered something in that exchange were not wrong in what they registered. The weekend moved at the pace of things that have nowhere to rush to. Long dinners with conversation that ranged from the practical to the philosophical and back without awkwardness, because they were among people who found both interesting and didn't need to choose between them. Morning rides in that particular early light that makes the world look like it's been freshly installed. An afternoon of informal music, someone at the piano, guests moving in and out, the kind of gathering that happens when nobody has organized a gathering but everyone has arrived in the same place in the same mood. Cecilia sat in the window seat of the music room on Saturday afternoon with a book she was genuinely reading and a cup of tea she was not drinking because the reading was more interesting, aware in the peripheral way she was aware of everything significant that Sebastian was 2 chairs away, engaged in a conversation about banking policy with Lord Aldbridge, and was also, clearly and without any particular attempt at concealment, aware of her. On the Saturday evening, after dinner had resolved itself into the comfortable clusters that evenings like these always produce, Cecilia went to the library. She had noticed, the previous morning during the house tour, a first edition of Wren's architectural drawings on the second shelf from the top, right side, and she had been thinking about it at intervals throughout the day the way you think about something you mean to get back to. Sebastian came in 5 minutes after she did. He looked at her on the library ladder, an excellent ladder, the rolling kind with a rail, the kind that tells you someone actually uses these shelves, and said, from the doorway. "Second shelf from the top, right side. The Wren. I remembered you mentioned it." She paused on the ladder, looking down at him. "You remembered. I remember most things you say." The same directness he brought to everything. Not as a technique. Because they're worth remembering. She came down with the book. The fire was lit, September evenings in Surrey insist upon it, and there were 2 chairs beside it, angled toward each other at the angle that invites conversation rather than performance. They sat at a. The house settled gently around them, doing what good houses do, which is make the people inside them feel that the outside world is very far away and that this is not a problem. They talked for 2 hours. About Wren. About architecture as language. About the way buildings encode the values of the people who built them, which led to an argument about whether the Blackwell House in Mayfair, which neither of them mentioned by name but both of them knew was in both their minds, was an example of a building encoding aspiration or encoding delusion. Sebastian said aspiration. Cecilia said the distinction was probably a matter of timing, aspiration before the money ran out, delusion after. He looked at her with the expression of a man who has been bested cleanly and is not unhappy about it. He did not propose that evening. He was not the sort of man who used the architecture of a significant moment as a stage set. He was the sort of man who said what he meant when he was sure he meant it and when the person he was saying it to was in a position to hear it clearly. What he said, that evening in the library, settling back in his chair with the ease of someone who has decided to stop being careful and just be honest, was, "I want to tell you something, with the caveat that I'm aware this is not the conventional moment or the conventional approach. I've found," Cecilia said, "that conventional approaches are primarily for the benefit of the audience. There's no audience here." "No," she agreed. "There isn't." He looked at her steadily. "I have been thinking about you with considerable persistence since March. I find your company more valuable than any other I can name. I would like, if you're willing and at whatever pace suits you, to continue in this direction and see where it leads. Honestly and without performance." The fire made small sounds. Outside, someone was playing the piano, a Schubert impromptu, one of the quieter ones. Cecilia held the Wren book in her lap, its leather cover warm from the firelight. She said, "I would find that acceptable." She paused, and the pause contained a great deal that would have required many more words from someone who was not her. "In fact, I would find it more than acceptable. I would find it exactly right." He smiled. The private smile, not the social one. The one that was only partly about what she'd said and partly about something in his chest that had been waiting for this answer since March. "Good," he said. "You mentioned 17 pages of infrastructure arguments. I have 18 now, actually. I kept adding to it." She opened the Wren book. "Then we have a great deal to discuss. Now, we must return, briefly but necessarily, to Adrian Blackwell, because a story like this one has obligations, and one of those obligations is the complete accounting of its villains. The engagement announcement appeared in the papers, The Times and the Morning Post, on a Thursday in October. The Marquis of Ashford and Miss Cecilia Voss. The notice was modest, factual, and, to anyone who had been following the story, which by this point included most of the social world of London and several of its outer orbits, quietly extraordinary. Three short sentences that contained an entire narrative for those who knew how to read it. The social response was, to put it charitably, vigorous. Women who had been politely silent at the engagement banquet, who had absorbed that scene with the particular discomfort of witnesses to an injustice, who had said nothing in the moment and had been carrying the guilt of it since, embraced this development with an enthusiasm that was partly genuine affection for Cecilia and partly the universal and deeply human pleasure in watching the arc bend correctly. Letters arrived. Cards arrived. Calls were made. Pemberton wrote a note that was three lines long and so perfectly expressed that Cecilia kept it in the top drawer of her writing desk where she could find it when she needed it. Eleanor cried, which was expected, but she also organized the entire correspondence response system, which was not expected and was extremely helpful and confirmed that Eleanor, beneath the blushing and the tears and the pretty social laughing, had considerably more backbone than she was generally given credit for. Cecilia accepted everything with the same quality of composed pleasure she brought to all things that were going right, present in the enjoyment without being swept away by it, grateful without being overcome, happy in the settled way of someone who has arrived somewhere they intended to go. Adrian received the news from Harley over breakfast, delivered with the expression of a man who had once found his position as chief chronicler of Adrian's social world amusing and now found it considerably less so, because the story had turned in a direction that implicated the chronicler by association. Adrian said nothing for 45 seconds, which was the longest he had gone without speaking at breakfast since he was 5 years old. Then he said, "Montague." "Yes," Harley confirmed. "Of Ashford." "The same." Another silence. Then, "I see." He picked up his newspaper. He read, or appeared to read, the same paragraph three times, which Harley could tell because Adrian's eyes weren't moving properly across the page, just hovering, unfocused, somewhere in the middle of the text. Then he set the paper down, requested more coffee, and said, "It won't last." Harley, who was finally, after 30 years of friendship with this man, beginning to understand the difference between what he thought and what Adrian wanted to hear, said nothing. He attended his club that afternoon and found that several of the men who usually sought him out to talk seemed to have pressing business elsewhere. Not rudely, never rudely, because their world was above all things well-mannered, but elsewhere, with the quiet deliberateness of men who are revising their social calculations in real time and have decided that proximity to Adrian Blackwell currently represents a certain kind of liability. It was the social version of a building settling. He went home early. The wedding was April. The church was St. George's, Hanover Square, because that is where these weddings happen, and while Cecilia had no particular attachment to the building itself, she had a sensible appreciation for the symbolism of doing things properly in front of the right number of witnesses. She spent the months between October and April not planning a wedding in the way that women are supposed to spend those months, consumed by the logistics of flowers and seating arrangements and whether the font is appropriate for the invitations. She spent those months doing what she always did, managing her affairs, reading, arguing with Sebastian by correspondence and in person, taking long walks, finishing the analysis of the Sheffield Mill investment that had been in her desk since August, and, in the margins of everything else, being quietly, steadily, enormously happy in a way that didn't require anyone else to see it. The dress was her own choice. She did not consult a committee. She found a dressmaker she trusted and described what she wanted with the specificity of someone who has spent 30 years knowing her own mind: silk, the color of winter sea, excellent cut, nothing unnecessary. The dressmaker, a woman named Mrs. Harriet Cole who had built her career on the principle that the best dress is the one that makes you look like yourself only more so, produced something that when Cecilia put it on caused Eleanor to sit down on the nearest chair and press both hands to her mouth and say nothing for 30 seconds, which was the longest Eleanor had ever been silent in living memory. The morning of the wedding, Cecilia sat at her dressing table while Eleanor arranged her hair with the focused care of someone performing a task they understand matters, and she looked at her own reflection in the glass with the same gray eyes that had looked at her own reflection every morning for 26 years, and she thought about her father, who had died when she was 21, and who had told her, once, in the study after a long business meeting during which she had sat quietly in the corner listening to things she wasn't supposed to understand and had understood completely, that the most valuable thing she could be was exactly what she was, and that anyone who told her otherwise was simply telling her about their own limitations. She thought, he would have liked Sebastian enormously. She thought, he would have found Adrian Blackwell amusing in the specific way that you find things amusing when they're going to be someone else's problem. She put on the dress. The church was full and fragrant and lit by the specific quality of April light that comes through old windows and makes everything look like it was painted. White flowers and pale green, chosen with intention. Handel filling the stone space from the choir, for men and for women, the music clean and serious and then suddenly warm, the way all the best things are. Eleanor walked in first, in pale gold, crying already, the tears impeccably managed with the skill of long practice. Then the doors opened. Cecilia walked down the aisle at her own pace, because she was not a woman who adjusted her pace for rooms. Her chin was level. Her hands were still. Her eyes found Sebastian at the altar and stayed there, and Sebastian, who was not given to public displays of emotion, looked at her with an expression so clearly and completely transparent that the wedding guests who saw it, all 200 of them, processed it in the wordless, universal language that certain expressions speak. Pemberton, in the fourth row, attended very carefully to the middle distance for approximately 4 minutes. He was 73. He had seen everything. He had also, in his view, never seen this particular thing, which was a woman who had been told she was too plain standing at the altar of a full church in a dress the color of winter sea, about to marry one of the most genuinely distinguished men in England, and looking, this was the specific part that Pemberton attended to the middle distance about, looking entirely, completely, always have been at home. The vows were traditional in their form. In their delivery they were something else. Sebastian said his looking at her, not at the priest or the congregation or the middle distance, because she was where his attention was and his attention was not a social performance. Cecilia said hers with the completeness of someone speaking a decision that was already made and was now simply being recorded. And then it was done. Or rather, it was beginning. The reception at Hartfield Park was everything that the house promised and nothing that needed to be catalogued. The food was excellent. The wine was better. The conversations were the kind you continued for years afterward, the kind that left you with new frameworks for old problems and a strong desire to find the person you were having the conversation with and have it again next week. Pemberton told three different people about Roman drainage systems and found, to his delight, that all three of them were interested, which he attributed to the quality of the guest list and was in one case actually correct. Toasts were made. Every one of them was genuine and several were funny and one, by a woman named Lady Aldbridge who had known Sebastian since childhood and had opinions about him that she had been refining for 30 years, made the room go momentarily quiet in the best possible way, the silence of people recognizing something true. There was dancing. Cecilia danced with Sebastian, which was the first dance, and then with Pemberton, who moved with the considered elegance of a man who had been excellent at this in 1845 and had retained the essential principles, and then with Eleanor's husband, a man named Thomas who was quiet and decent and had loved Eleanor since they were 19 with the steady warmth of a good fire, and who showed absolutely no signs of revising this position now or ever. Late in the evening, in the interval between the dancing and the point where the good conversation clusters settle into something more permanent, Sebastian appeared beside her with two glasses of champagne and the look of a man at the end of the best evening of his life so far, who is already thinking about the next one. He handed her a glass. They stood together at the edge of the terrace, looking out at the Surrey night, which was doing an excellent impression of being exactly as beautiful as it looked. He said, "Are you happy?" She was quiet for a moment. Not because she didn't know. Because she was precise with language and she wanted to be precise about this. "I'm something better than happy," she said. "Happy is a temperature. This is a structure." She paused. "A very warm structure, though." He looked at her. The firelight from the house behind them caught his face at the angle that made him look exactly like what he was. "I'll take it." "You should," she said. "Structures last longer." She leaned very slightly against his shoulder, the first entirely spontaneous gesture she could remember making in company in years, and they stood there in the September into April into forever night, and the house was at their backs, and the stars were making their usual argument for their own importance, and the conversation inside was continuing without them because it didn't need them at this particular moment. 18 pages, Sebastian said, after a while. "About the infrastructure investment." "I know. I was thinking we could go through them on the train."
"To where?"
"Italy," he said. "The aqueducts." She turned and looked at him. The winter sea was warm. He was watching her with the expression that was going to take her years to fully describe and which she was already certain she would never tire of seeing. "We're going to Italy," she said, "to look at aqueducts. And other things. On our honeymoon. I thought you'd find it interesting."
"I find it extremely interesting."
"Good," he said. "Then we're compatible." She laughed. The real laugh, chest first, no permission. And the night was warm around them, and the house was full of light, and everything that needed to be said had been said, and everything that needed to happen had either happened or was in the process of beginning. And Adrian Blackwell drove past the church in Hanover Square that morning in a carriage, twice, and told himself he didn't know why. He knew why. He drove home. He poured a drink. He sat in his very handsome, very gilded, very heavily mortgaged dining room, and he was quiet for a long time, which was unusual for him, and in the quiet he thought about, though he would never in his life have articulated it this clearly, the cost of seeing only what you've been trained to see. The specific and expensive cost of looking at something of depth and calling it shallow, because depth requires you to look carefully and looking carefully requires you to admit that your first impression might have been wrong, and men like Adrian Blackwell had been protected from that admission for so long that they'd mistaken the protection for intelligence. He thought about the word utility. He didn't pour a second drink. The Dowager Duchess Miriam, informed of the wedding by a society columnist she trusted, read the announcement and said, to no one in particular, in her empty morning room, "Good for her." Then she went back to the correspondence she'd been attending to, and the small smile she wore for the next hour went unremarked because there was no one in the room to remark on it, which was, on reflection, rather a pity. And 6 years later, in the library at Hartfield Park, the library with the rolling ladder and the excellent Wren edition and the chairs angled toward each other beside the fire, Cecilia sat across from Sebastian with the latest edition of the engineering journal open on her knee and a cup of tea at her elbow going cold, because the article on Brunel suspension bridges was more interesting than the tea, which she considered to be as it should be. 3 children were somewhere in the house, their son of 4, with his mother's gray eyes and his father's focused attention, the twin daughters of 2, who were ungovernable in the specific way of children who have been loved by people who are not afraid of their personalities. Ungovernable by others, that is. With Cecilia they were somehow always, at the last moment, governable, because she had the trick of speaking to them as though their reasons mattered, which they found disarming, because it was true.
Sebastian was at his desk across the room. He looked up, found her looking at the journal with the expression of someone who has just read something that has given her an opinion, and said, "The Brunel piece?" "He underestimated the lateral wind load by about 12%, she said. "It's been bothering me for 20 minutes. Write to the journal." "I might." She looked across at him. The gray eyes, steady and warm and full of things. "Do you know that it's been 6 years?"
"Since what?"
She raised an eyebrow. He set down his pen. "Ah? You owe me 18 pages, she said. "I've been waiting." He looked at her for a moment with the expression that she had spent 6 years and had still not found the single right word for, and then he reached into the drawer of his desk and produced a sheaf of papers, dense with writing, annotated in the margins, covered in his characteristically direct handwriting, and set them on the corner of the desk. She looked at the papers. Looked at him.
"You had them ready."
"I've been adding to them for 6 years, he said. "I wasn't sure when you'd ask. Were you going to just keep adding to them indefinitely?"
"I was going to give them to you when you asked," he said, with perfect simplicity.
"You asked." She stood up, crossed the room, picked up the sheaf of papers. She read the first page standing there, and then the second, and by the third she sat down in the chair beside his desk, still reading. He went back to his own work. The fire made its small sounds. Outside, the girls were audible somewhere in the garden, a sound of determined pursuit and the periodic complaint of someone who had been caught. Their son's voice, asking a question that required a complete answer. The house settled quietly around them all. Cecilia read. Sebastian wrote. The light changed over the grounds in the long afternoon way of English autumn. At some point she said, without looking up from the pages, "You're wrong about the Sheffield investment on page 7.
"I know," he said, without looking up from his own desk. "I put it in to see how long it took you."
"For minutes. That's faster than last time." She turned the page. The small smile was the real one, the one that started in the chest and didn't ask permission. She read on. And in the warmth of the house, in the quiet that was not empty but inhabited entirely and completely, in the life she had built, with her own hands, her own mind, her own refusal to be defined by a word that was never true, Cecilia Montague, née Voss, was exactly where she had always known she would eventually be. Which is to say, exactly herself. Which was, and had always been, more than enough. The stars came out over Surrey, one by one, as they always do, unhurried and without explanation, needing no one's permission to shine. There is a house in Surrey with a rolling library ladder and a view over grounds that are tended with care by people who understand that beauty and function are not opposites. There is a fire in the library most evenings, and two chairs beside it angle toward each other, and a woman in one of them who reads three newspapers, speaks four languages, can calculate a lateral wind load in her head, and laughs with her whole chest when something is genuinely funny. There is a man in the other chair who listens as carefully as he reads and writes letters that run to 9 pages and has never once, in 6 years, described anything about her as plain. There are 3 children somewhere in the house, and an ancient Wren edition on the second shelf from the top, and a note from Pemberton in the top drawer of the writing desk that says, in his precise elderly hand, "She was remarkable before any of this. The remarkable part was always her." He was right. He usually was, about aqueducts and other important things. And the night, as it always does, was warm. Now let's be honest with each other, because you and I have been in this story together long enough that we can afford that kind of honesty. There is a version of Cecilia's story that ends at the wedding and calls itself complete. A version that frames everything she did as a response to what was done to her, as though the only reason she was interesting was because Adrian Blackwell gave her a reason to be. As though the extraordinary thing about her was the distance she travelled from the engagement banquet to the altar of St. George's, Hanover Square, and the satisfying arithmetic of that distance, measured in one man's humiliation and another man's ring and address the colour of winter sea. But that is not what makes Cecilia Voss extraordinary, and if you have been paying the right kind of attention, you already know this. What makes her extraordinary is that she was always this woman. Before the banquet. Before the letter. Before the concert in March and the engineering journal and the rolling library ladder and the man who remembered which shelf held the Wren edition and had been adding to an 18-page letter for 6 years, waiting for her to ask. She was already reading 3 newspapers a day. She was already managing her own estate with a precision that made solicitors quietly, without announcement, revise their assumptions about women's capacity for numbers. She was already the woman who talked about Roman aqueducts with Lord Pemberton at a dinner she hadn't particularly wanted to attend, and found genuine delight in it, and did not perform a different, more decorative interest just because that different interest would have read more legibly as femininity to the people in the room watching her. The engagement banquet didn't reveal who she was. It revealed who Adrian was. She already knew who she was. She had known for quite some time. She had been introduced to herself somewhere around the age of 14, in her father's study, during a late night when he let her sit in on a business meeting because she had asked to and he saw no good reason to say no, and she had listened to men twice her age discuss things three times their comprehension and she had understood every word. Cornelius Vos had watched his daughter's face in the lamplight that evening and known something that parents sometimes know about their children, which is that the child is going to be fine regardless of what happens to them, because they have already found the thing inside themselves that holds. This is the thing about people who are genuinely confident. Not the performed confidence of those who need rooms to agree with them, but the structural confidence of those who have built themselves from the inside out, over years, through reading and thinking and refusing to pretend not to understand things that they understand. They are not produced by their difficulties. The difficulties reveal them, yes, in the way that pressure reveals the quality of what it is applied to. But the quality was there before the pressure. It is always there before the pressure. Adrian Blackwell called her plain because he was looking for something to perform. An observation that would make him seem amusingly candid, self-aware about the pragmatic nature of the match, somehow elevated above the social convention of pretending to feelings he did not have. He wanted to seem sophisticated. He wanted the room to think, here is a man who sees things clearly. Instead, the room thought, here is a man who is going to regret this within the week, and they were right, except that it took slightly longer than a week because Adrian was also a man who required extra time to locate his regrets. He had a system for avoiding them that was quite advanced and had been running continuously for about 28 years, so the machinery needed longer than usual to catch up. Plain. The word that means, I looked and I saw nothing interesting. Which is one of the most revealing sentences a person can speak, when you think about it properly. Not because it tells you about what they saw. Because it tells you everything about how they look. What Adrian revealed at that dinner table was not a fact about Cecilia. It was a measurement of his own capacity. And the measurement was not flattering. Here is what Harley told a mutual acquaintance, about 2 years after the wedding, over drinks at a club that Adrian no longer frequented because the atmosphere had become subtly and persistently uncomfortable for him in the specific way that atmospheres become uncomfortable when a room has collectively decided something about you and is too polite to say so directly. The thing is, she was never plain. Adrian just didn't know how to look at anything that didn't announce itself. If it didn't shout, he didn't hear it. If it didn't shine in the particular obvious way he recognized as shining, he called it dull. He walked through his whole life half-blind and thought the problem was in the things he couldn't see. The mutual acquaintance, a woman named Lady De Vere who had been at the engagement banquet and had spent the subsequent 2 years feeling guilty about her own silence during it, asked, "Do you think he knows that now?" Harley considered this with the gravity of a man who had known Adrian for 35 years and had spent considerable recent time updating his understanding of what that friendship had cost him, in choices made and instincts suppressed and things left unsaid that should have been said 20 years earlier. "I think," Harley said carefully, with the new precision of a man who has started choosing his words instead of letting his mouth choose them, "that he knows something is wrong. I don't think he knows what it is. And I believe those are among the most expensive words in the English language, something is wrong." Lady De Vere agreed. She nodded, looked at her wine, and said, "I should have said something that night." "Yes," Harley said. "So should I." They sat with that for a moment, which is the right thing to do with that kind of acknowledgement. And then they talked about other things, because even important recognitions need eventually to give way to the evening continuing. Adrian, meanwhile, was managing. He was always managing. This was his great unsung skill, the ability to manage in the face of circumstances of his own making, through the combination of surface charm and persistent hope and the quiet, unacknowledged misery of someone who suspects the life they're living is smaller than the life they could have had but has no idea what they would have had to change to get there. He refinanced the estate. He maintained his social position with the effort that maintaining anything requires when the foundation has been quietly undermined. He attended dinners and was charming and said things that made people laugh, because that was what he had, and it was not nothing. He married a woman named Patricia Harwood, pleasant and well-connected, who had been told that Adrian Blackwell was a good match and had not been told the full story of why the previous match had dissolved, or had been told a version of it so heavily edited in Adrian's favor that it bore only a geographic resemblance to what had actually occurred. She was pleasant. She was also quietly, steadily, completely bored by him within 18 months, which she managed with the invisible competence of a woman who has learned to live alongside a reality she cannot change, and who has therefore built a rich and varied internal life that the person beside her has absolutely no idea exists. Adrian never knew about the internal life. He looked at Patricia and saw a pleasant woman who was content, which is a very specific failure of vision that would have been familiar to anyone paying attention to the pattern. There is one more scene before we are truly done. It takes place at a concert. The same concert hall. The same charity series, different year, different program, same children's hospital that Cecilia had been funding for 5 years through the foundation she and Sebastian had established, which bore her mother's name and specialized in pediatric surgical care for families who couldn't afford it. Same cause. Different evening. Cecilia and Sebastian arrived on time. They always arrived on time, because arriving late to things, Sebastian had said once, is a way of announcing that your time matters more than other people's, and he had yet to find evidence that this was true of himself. Third row. The acoustics, as Cecilia had long established, were best in the third row, center left. Sebastian had hot chocolate from the vestibule because he had, in the past year, developed a strong and inexplicable opinion about concert hall hot chocolate, which Cecilia found both baffling and entirely characteristic, because he did this with things, formed opinions about small pleasures with the same precise attention he gave to large investments, and she had learned to find it one of the better things about him. Two rows behind them, for seats to the right, Adrian Blackwell arrived alone. Patricia was at her mother's, or had a headache. The specific reason had been getting considerable exercise recently, which anyone paying attention would have read correctly. He took his seat. He looked at the program. He looked up. Across those two rows and four seats, he saw the back of Cecilia's head. Dark hair, simply arranged. Beside her, Sebastian, leaning slightly toward her to say something in the low pre-concert register of someone making a private observation. She turned toward him. And she smiled. The real smile. The one that started in the chest and didn't ask the room for permission. Not performed. Not managed. Just there, in her face, entirely without architecture, given freely to the person who had said the thing that produced it. Adrian looked at that smile for the 2 seconds before she turned back to the stage. He had never, in 3 years of knowing her, made her produce that smile. He had, if he was working toward honesty, which he was doing slowly and without a clear destination in mind, never actually tried. He had been too busy performing the story of himself in a room full of people to pay attention to what was sitting 3 seats to his left, with gray eyes and a mind like a precision instrument, reading 3 newspapers and understanding things he had never thought to ask about. He looked back at his program. The Haydn Quartet began. The first notes arrived in the hall with the particular quality of Haydn in a good space, orderly, precise, warm beneath the precision. Constructed. Intentional. Something made with both engineering and care, in which the craft and the warmth were inseparable. He thought, very quietly, very briefly, in the private space behind the public face, I was wrong about her. Then the music continued, and the thought didn't go anywhere, because Adrian was not yet ready to take it anywhere. It sat in him, a small and uncomfortable thing, in the place where people keep the things they are not quite ready to look at directly. And 2 rows ahead, Cecilia heard the same music and thought nothing in particular about Adrian Blackwell, because she had not thought about Adrian Blackwell in quite some time, which was not a choice she had made actively, just the natural result of a life that was full in all the directions that mattered, with no space for things that didn't belong there. She thought about the children's hospital, which was doing well. She thought about the infrastructure report on her desk at home, which she wanted to finish before Thursday. She thought about Sebastian, which she did without drama, simply the background warmth of thinking about someone who is a fact of your life in the best possible way, reliable as architecture, interesting as everything you keep discovering about them. She thought, this is what a good life feels like. The music played on. Outside, the London night went about its London business. Somewhere in Surrey, the twins were being put to bed with the difficulty that always attended this process, their small voices carrying through the house with the specific persistence of children who have not finished having opinions yet and see no reason why sleep should prevent them from expressing the remaining ones. Their brother, in the room adjacent, had already been asleep for 45 minutes, because he had inherited his mother's ability to make decisions and then execute them without drama. The housekeeper, Mrs. Mabel Frost, who had been with the Montague household for 11 years and regarded its current configuration as the best version of it she had seen, put her head around the door of the twins' room and deployed the particular look she had developed over 2 years of this specific challenge, which was a look that conveyed, "I have waited you out before and I will wait you out again, and the mathematics of this situation are not in your favor." The twins looked at each other. They looked at Mrs. Frost. They lay down. The house grew quiet. The stars came out over Surrey, one by one and then all at once, in the way they always do, without needing permission. And everything was exactly as it should be. This is the thing about a good life. Not a perfect life. Perfect lives exist only in the imaginations of people who have never had to build one and therefore don't know what the building costs. A good life is different from a perfect life in the same way that a good house is different from a perfect house. The good house has the rolling library ladder that sticks slightly on the left rail and which you've learned to navigate because you know the house, and the fireplace that takes 3 matches in winter, and the window in the east room that rattles in high wind, and all these things are yours, known, manageable, and entirely preferable to a perfect house that you live in as a stranger because you never had to learn it. Cecilia Voss's life was good in this way. The precise, exact, hard one, continually interesting goodness of something built by someone who knew what they were building and why, with the person who understood the same plans and found them interesting enough to keep working on indefinitely. She never stopped managing the estate that her father built, even after the marriage, because it was hers and she was interested in it and because the idea that marriage was an ending rather than a complication was not one she had ever been able to take seriously. Sebastian never suggested she stop, because he was not the kind of man who found his wife's competence threatening, being secure enough in his own that it operated at no cost to hers. They had occasionally competing views on investment timing and regional development strategy and whether the Northern Mill should be converted or retooled, and they had these arguments in the productive, interested way of two people who respect each other's thinking enough to push back on it. She won more of these arguments than he did. He acknowledged this freely and without resentment, because winning the argument was less interesting to him than getting the analysis right, and she consistently got the analysis right, and he was sufficiently adult to find this a feature rather than an obstacle. Their son, at the age of 4, asked his mother what an aqueduct was. She explained it for 20 minutes. He listened for all 20 minutes with an expression of focused attention that was so recognizably hers that Sebastian, watching from the doorway, had to turn away and look at something neutral for a moment. The twins, at age 2, had no opinions about aqueducts yet. They had opinions about everything else, delivered simultaneously and at volume, and Cecilia received these opinions with the same patient, interested attention she gave to everything that was trying to tell her something, which drove them, intermittently, toward a kind of grudging cooperation that Mrs. Frost considered nothing short of architectural in its achievement. Pemberton came for Christmas, as he had come for Christmas since the first year of the marriage, which he had declared the most sensible arrangement he had encountered in several decades of attending other people's Christmases. He brought books for the children. He told extremely long stories about hydraulic engineering to anyone who would listen, and in this household, several people would listen, which he found genuinely sustaining. He was 81. He was still the sharpest person in most rooms he entered, and he knew it, and he carried this knowledge with the good humor of someone who has decided that longevity is a gift and intends to be grateful rather than self-congratulatory about it. On the last evening of one of these Christmas visits, when the children were in bed and the house was quiet and the four of them, Cecilia, Sebastian, Pemberton, and Eleanor, who had brought Thomas and who was currently sitting very close to him on the settee in the way of people who have been married for 4 years and still find the proximity agreeable, sat around the fire with wine and the pleasant exhaustion of a good day, Pemberton said. "I want to say something, which I should perhaps have said earlier and didn't, because I am old enough to know when to wait for the right moment." Everyone looked at him. "I was at that dinner," he said. He didn't specify which dinner. He didn't need to. I heard what he said. And I said nothing, which I regret, because I was a guest in someone else's house and I told myself it wasn't my place. He paused. "But what I wanted to say then, and what I will say now, is that I have known a great many people in a long life, and I have met perhaps 5 or 6 in that entire time who could be described as genuinely remarkable. And you, my dear," he said, looking at Cecilia with the simple directness of the very old, who have run out of time for indirection, "were always one of them. Before the aqueducts. Before all of this. You were already remarkable when you walked into that dining room, and the only thing that changed was that the remarkable eventually made itself undeniable. The room was quiet for a moment. Outside, the wind moved through the Surrey trees. Cecilia looked at Pemberton for a moment, and something in her face went briefly, quietly, entirely open, the way faces go when they receive something they didn't know they were waiting for, and then settled back into itself. "Thank you," she said. Simply. Without the performance of being moved, though she was moved. "Don't thank me," Pemberton said. "I'm only stating facts. I've been doing it for 81 years. I find it suits me." Eleanor cried. Thomas handed her a handkerchief. Sebastian refilled Pemberton's glass. The fire made its small sounds. The house was warm. And in that room, on that evening, in the good warm reliable life that was exactly hers, Cecilia Voss sat in the chair she had chosen, in the house she had partly built, surrounded by people who knew what she was worth, and thought, "Yes. This is right. This is exactly right. As it always was going to be. As it always was." The epilogue, because she would have wanted it short and the story has earned its ending. There is a house in Surrey with a rolling library ladder and a view over grounds that are tended with care. There is a fire in the library most evenings and two chairs beside it, and in those chairs, two people who have been building something together for 6 years and intend to continue, in the productive, interested, laughing way of people who find each other genuinely interesting and have decided this is more than sufficient reason to keep going. There are three children somewhere in the house, always somewhere, with grey eyes and strong opinions and the bone-deep certainty of children who have been loved clearly, which is that the world is a place where they belong. There is a note in the top drawer of the writing desk that says, in an elderly and precise hand, "She was remarkable before any of this. The remarkable part was always her." And there is a woman in the library, reading by firelight, with tea gone cold at her elbow because the reading was more interesting than the tea, who knows this about herself with the same settled certainty she has always brought to things that are simply true. Completely. Always. Without needing it confirmed. And somewhere in the house, a door opens, and a child's voice asks a question that requires a complete and considered answer, and the woman sets down her book and gives one, because that is who she is, that is who she has always been, fully and without apology, in every room and every hour of the good life she built. Outside, the stars are at their posts. Inside, the fire is warm. And everything, at last and always, is exactly as it should be.